July 6, 1978. This tape is intended for the convention. The big fact of this past year has been the passing of Gertrude. She left us on the 28th of May, 1978, and thereby precipitated a complex psychical condition of well-nigh monumental proportions. This blow has affected me in the profoundest degree. It involves much more than the usual experience of a husband losing a wife. It affects indeed the possibility of all further continuation of this work, insofar as I am connected with it. There have been two competent analysts who have evaluated the situation, and both have determined that much more than a personal loss has been experienced, but something even of collective importance has been involved. For this reason, I am dealing with this subject matter at this convention, for Gertrude's loss is more than a private loss. At midnight on December 21st, 1928, Sharifa and I founded the Assembly of Man. From that time forward, there were many lecture trips consummated, and many workings with individual sadhikas. Sharifa was the head of the organization, and I maintained the greater part of the lecture activity, primarily oriented to the esoteric philosophy. In connection with this activity, we began the effort for the building of an ashram up in Tuttle Creek Canyon in the midst of the Sierra Nevada Mountains, and met during summer or vacation periods when the students were able to come to render help, built a building out of rock in the form of a balanced cross. The symbolism of this was the emphasis of the principle of balance or equilibrium. this effort continued through most of the years up until 1950, which was the last year that Sharifa was sufficiently strong to come to the summer activities. After that, she declined. We continued activity in our home in San Fernando, where I continued to lecture, and a certain number of people came out to attend the lectures. But by 1956, Sharifa had deteriorated further, so that these activities were discontinued. And having sold a portion of our land, we moved to Santa Barbara, near the sea, where Sharifa wanted to be. She, however, had very little enjoyment of activity in this area before she became bed-bound, and her body deteriorated until, on February 23rd, 1959, she passed away from us. In those days, I strove to support her in every way that I could. One individual who was a clairvoyant and a practitioner of hypnotherapy said that I was keeping her alive, even though she wanted to withdraw. But I saw no other course, for personally, she seemed always to want to live. And I told her we would support her as long as we could. Toward the end, she developed gangrene, and that I recognized as an impossible situation. So I deliberately withdrew the support, and she passed in within 24 hours. Now, we had her lying in state for 24 hours so that there would be time for the complete withdrawal of the inner entity. Then we had the funeral, at which I officiated, both in the funeral room and at graveside. And then we withdrew, and her relatives left, and I entered in to an experience of desolation. I found myself seemingly bleeding subtle blood. I've been told since that this was an actual bleeding of the life force itself. I could not stop it by any act of will. But I found that when near a very few feminine entities, the bleeding stopped. I faced this decision or question. The bleeding seemed to indicate for me the end of life if it was not staunched. I asked this: shall I let myself pass in and discontinue to work, or shall I seek someone who will be able, by something that she is or has, to staunch that bleeding? I decided to continue the work, and I sought a companion that would render this work possible. That companion proved to be Gertrude. When I became associated with her, the bleeding stopped, and I was in control of my faculties. We were associated for 19 years, in which we continued the work. I produced probably more material upon tapes than all I had produced before in those 19 years, thereby implying that this combination with Gertrude was productive. And let it be remembered that if these tapes have any value for you, give credit to her who rendered them possible. The relationship between Gertrude and myself was never a biological relationship, but it was a productive combination of the masculine and feminine principles on the level of the work which was originally founded by Sharifa and myself in 1928. It was a working relationship, and it was a relationship of extraordinary felicity and effective productiveness. Never a quarrel between us, never a cross word. Now she has departed, and I find myself unable, at least at present, to produce in the terms that I formerly produced. I've gone through a well-nigh monumental experience of psychological processes that produce an effect well-nigh like a tornado, so that I cannot, at the present time, reach into philosophic calm that leads to the kind of production that I developed. At present, I seem to wish to speak only of her and of the implications with respect to my own processes and the implications also that may affect future effort. Will there be anything more produced for this effort in the assembly of men that began on the 21st of December, 1928? I am told that the capstone has not yet been finished, that there is further work to do, and that the withdrawal of Gertrude was necessary to render this final production possible. Two men with analytic capacity have analyzed the situation, and a great dream that I had on the order of 50 years ago, which they both determined as pointing to the events of the present hour. I'll sketch this dream into the tape so that it'll be immediately available for us. The dream was located in a theater, which was empty except for those who participated in the action. The theater was arranged with the stage a little above the floor of the orchestra, with a means of access to the aisles, one on the right and one on the left, that went back in the room, so that the performers were able to move from the stage to the aisles. Over the right aisle, there was a box in which sat a figure with a beard who carried numinous value. On the stage, there was a bed and a young woman in a state of extremity was resting upon it. I and my own proper person seemed to be fused with the sage-like figure in the box, who was seated just above the right aisle. Before the beginning of the drama, the sage apparently had said something to someone to his right in the box, but I did not see this someone. I do not know whether it was male or female. And the sage had remarked that the drama that was about to take place concerned this one, and that he should go to the stage, which he did. My impression was that it might have been the shadow in the Jungian system of archetypes. The stage opened, the scene on the stage opened with the entrance of Mephisto, who began a dance of heroic proportions and of more than human precision. As the dance developed, it seemed to arouse a magnetic condition that lifted the young woman out of her bed so that she took part in the dance. The dance increased in fury. the steps were totally beyond the possibility of a mere human being. It grew in fury until it could be no longer contained by the stage. Then the young woman, followed by Mephisto, proceeded to continue the dance down the right aisle, around in back, and then up the left aisle to the stage again, and made a series of circlings. But presently it became evident that the young woman was failing to maintain herself, that she was in danger of being absorbed by the powerful Mephisto. And then, and only then, the sage intervened. It seemed that the power of Mephisto was almost equal to that of the sage. But in one respect, the sage could overcome him. It was by directing the forces of love and hate in rapid alternation. It seemed that either force by itself could not have controlled Mephisto. He could have brushed aside the force of love or hate itself, but the rapid alteration from one to the other threw him off his balance. And as he came down the right aisle from the stage, he looked up at the sage, and I saw anger in his eyes. He shot at the sage a force which came in the appearance of bullets, which the sage caught in his mouth and spewed back to him. And then I awoke with a sense of victory. I felt this sense of victory for several days afterwards in a kind of glow. And it was my impression that if this outcome had not been victorious, there never would have been the events of 1936 when the realization broke through. Two analysts just last month submitted these dreams to analysis. These analysts were Dr. Brewjoy and Robert Johnson. They both agree in affirming that the working out of this dream, though it took place nearly 50 years ago, is at the present time. They both agree that the dream has more than a personal significance. That indeed it has a collective significance. That though I am the dreamer and am personally, intimately involved, yet what I may do with it carries a meaning and value beyond myself to others. It is even suggested that what I have had to work through will in time be worked through by others at some level of consciousness. This implies, therefore, that I have more than a personal responsibility here, but that I have indeed a collective responsibility, that I have a duty to perform. Now, they further agree that Mephisto represents the intellect or Buddhi, that the young woman represents the anima, namely the feminine elements in a masculine entity, namely myself. And the sage is a superordinate power that looks down from above, not interfering until emergency is imminent. Now the implication on which they both agree is that the development of intellectual capacity within myself had become so far along and so extreme that it had absorbed the energy of the woman in the man, or in other words, the anima, that she was brought near to exhaustion, that she had never developed because the energy of development had all been absorbed by the intellectual side. That disaster had been averted by the intervention of the sage. Now, there are facts in my personal life that tend to confirm this, and I shall briefly refer to them. I was the son of a Methodist clergyman, and the influence of my early years that remained significant was the influence of the home, the church, and the school. As I look back at the thinking of the days before adolescence, that thought was not my own, but reflected the influence about me. But when I became a teenager and adolescence broke out, which was the year of 1900, I began to think for myself. I accepted the ethical discipline of the church, which was a modified form of Puritanism. And, however, I began reflecting upon the religious doctrines. In those days, I often paced the streets in the pitch dark, for there was no illumination then, thinking on theological problems. And ultimately rejected much of theological jargon. I felt the awakening of the interest in the girl and of the boy's interest in sport, but this became largely repressed and thought took all the interest. Thought continued to do so as I grew, and indeed has dominated my life up to the present. The capacity of that mind, 1 Phi Beta Kappa, at the end of 4 years in college, and at the end of the 5th, a scholarship to Harvard offered to 1 student of the University of Stanford or the University at Berkeley by the Harvard Club of San Francisco. At Stanford, I majored in the mathematics department, namely the pure mathematics department, for the 2 departments, applied and pure, were separate. At Harvard, I entered the Graduate School of Philosophy. I do not remember that I ever failed a single problem in those years. At the end of my 4th year, one of the professors in the mathematics department suggested that he would put a course in the curriculum on the foundations of geometry, which was along the lines of Hilbert's work, if I cared to take the course, and I said I would. A professor in the philosophy department said you'd put a course into the curriculum on the Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant if I wished to take it, and I said I would. And I went through both courses in my 5th year as the only student and passed them fully. Meanwhile, I was not courting the girls, as is characteristic of most young men. I even, to a degree, was courted by 1 of them, but that never developed to an effective conclusion. My orientation was to the masculine mind, and I did not have too high an opinion of the feminine mind. It is true that I oriented strongly to thought and to the masculine consciousness throughout those years. And I reached the point where I regarded no problem as lying beyond the potential of thought research. And I did not hesitate to penetrate into that zone which more men consider generally to be a sacred zone beyond the range of thought. This all implies that there are facts to back up the evidence that Mephisto was a predominant power, and that the development of the feminine side in the man was weak and backward. Meanwhile, another influence entered into my life. One day, when I was in the post office of Palo Alto, I saw a sign of meetings of a theosophical group. My curiosity was piqued, I heard my father once speak disparagingly of theosophy, and I was immediately interested. So I undertook to go to a meeting of this group. I found it to be a branch of what was known as the Temple of the People, a theosophical organization that had sprung up after the death of H.P. Lee and W.Q. Judge. They were under, or seemed to be under, the administration of one of the brothers known as Hilarion. Instructions were given by him through one of the heads of the group by the means of Tulku. In my experience in this group, I received three personal communications from this source. In the course of events, I had arrived at Halcyon, where this group was, headquarters of this group was located, in 1915. I decided to take the course of vegetarian diet, not for dietetic reasons, but for ethical reasons, because the eating of meat implied the killing of creatures, and that seemed to me ethically objectionable. I followed this vegetarian diet for a year and a half and developed chronic indigestion, and then received a message from the one called Hilarion telling me to desist. And I did. And I've not been interested in vegetarian diet since. It took 10 years to correct the tendency to the indigestion. On another occasion, while at Harvard, I had become interested in Indian sources, namely East Indian sources, and I laid my plans to get to India. I succeeded in getting an offer of a teaching position in a missionary school in the field of mathematics. But I wrote to headquarters at Halcyon and received another message to the effect, "The child of the East will find his call to action in the west wind." It would seem that if you return to India, you may be taken up by Indian quietism. I interpreted this to mean that I should not so return. And also, in the days when the First World War broke out, I had the strong orientation to the position of the conscientious objector. And it was a crisis in my life at that time. I received a third instruction to the effect, "A greater than I have said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but render unto God the things that are God's. God's law says, thou shalt not kill. If there is a contradiction between Caesar's law and God's law, it would seem that God's law should prevail." I interpreted this as meaning that I should continue with the demands of Caesar insofar as it did not involve actual killing, although I had the discomfort of realizing that whatever I did helped that end. I served the Army and was received an honorable discharge. But let us return to that fateful day in 1909 when I first walked over to the residence on Waverly Street in Palo Alto. I entered in through the door and found people seated in the square. Later I learned that officers of the group sat in the four corners, and I listened to the reading of instructions that were very strange to me, and later readings in Edward Carpenter's Towards Democracy. Here was a way of thinking and valuing totally different from that which I found in the university. Nonetheless, I was intrigued, and so I returned again and became even more interested and ultimately a regular attendant. A relationship grew up between me and those who dwelt in that house, which became ultimately very warm. And I was finally told to enter at will without knocking. But I was not satisfied with the soundness of the thinking. And the result was that for 3 years I disputed the soundness of his position with the leader of the group. Meanwhile, feeling yet there was something here. It was a kind of thinking that was totally foreign with respect to that which I had found in the university. I knew the scientific soundness of university teaching. I knew mathematics and philosophy, or was experiencing it at that time. And yet here was something that seemed to make an appeal to another possibility. Ultimately, I was sufficiently interested to make a tentative association with the entity known as the Temple of the People. I became a member and attended its convention in 1912, just before I went for the year at Harvard. But I was not yet fully convinced that here was a door to truth. It was an intriguing possibility, but there were many elements that were not satisfactory. Actually, what I had here contacted was a group of people in whom the intuitive function was very substantially developed, and their way of thinking involved something strange as compared to the rationally disciplined and organized thinking of a logical sort characteristic of university teaching. Ultimately, I became so much acquainted with the intuitive type that I learned both its strength and its weakness. At its best, when it is on beam, it reaches into possibilities that are not available by other means. But just as there is in the field of rational thought a distinction between true logical thinking and sophistry, the problem that was arose at the time of Plato and his predecessors, so there is in the action of the intuitive type a positive and a negative side. When the intuitive is on beam, he may reach in to relatively impossible knowledge. When he is off beam, he may jump to most ridiculous conclusions that are not at all tenable. One has to use discrimination in dealing with the matter brought forth by the intuitive type. Intuition, when sufficiently balanced by thinking, can be corrected in this respect. But intuitives who are not sufficiently balanced by trained thinking do produce some propositions that are incredibly ridiculous. I've learned to differentiate in the course of time between these two aspects of the intuitive type. The result was that for 3 years I disputed this position with the leader of the group. Every night after meeting, I would dispute with him, perhaps out in the street or the sidewalk or in his house, but meanwhile becoming convinced that there was something here that deserved serious attention. Meanwhile, I had become a friend of the family and of the associates in the group. And the time came when I was told not to knock when I came to the house, but to enter in as though I belonged to it. We have spent many trips out in the hills to the west of Palo Alto, and in many ways those were happy days. But in due course, the time to go to Harvard approached, and I went there, matriculated in the Graduate School of Philosophy, and took a series of courses, which included symbolic logic, the work under present philosophic tendencies, a course in the philosophy of religion, and 2 seminars, one in epistemology and one in metaphysics. The thing that was decisive here was certain discussion that took place in the metaphysics seminar, which was administered under the direction of Dr. Bakewell, a professor at Yale, and the same one who was a professor under which Northrop had been a student and later a colleague, the same Northrop that wrote the very suggestive book called The Meeting of East and West. One student in the seminar in metaphysics, presented a paper when his time came around, which was a formulation in terms of a certain modification of the Vedantic type of thought. This was fairly close to the theosophical thought that I had heard in the temple meetings. I heard him and saw him defend himself successfully against the critics. He was a Scotsman, a very brilliant man, who was completing his fourth year of graduate study with a PhD that year. This impressed me. Here I heard for the first time a successful critical defense of a position that I had been tentatively entertaining, but had not yet reached to a decisive conclusion. At the end of the year, sometime during the summer, I received an invitation to return to Stanford to teach certain courses that were normally taught by Dr. Bickfeld, but who was now due for his sabbatical year. For financial reasons, I decided to accept this offer and did return to Stanford and taught mathematics for that academic year. Meanwhile, I had been meditating and thinking about this other way of thought and of light. So I faced this situation. If this other way is indeed true, if there is another way of cognition that is not recognized in the academy at that time, then the kind of knowledge rendered available by that other way of cognition, if it exists, is so important that no philosophic statement could be adequate which neglects its existence. So I came to the decision to make a search to verify whether this way of cognition was indeed existed and was valid. It resulted in my withdrawing from the university world, and in effect, that was the sacrificial offering made preliminary to the search. I had been developing to the point where I would have had an academic career, either in the field of mathematics or the field of philosophy. And it was the line of activity to which I was most devoted. In effect, that became the sacrificial offering. For the move that I made was a move I later found was incompatible with continuing in the academic world. When I completed my year of teaching mathematics at Stanford in 1914, I began the search. by proceeding southward into the Santa Lucia Mountains, south of Carmel, California, for the purpose of establishing a sort of group in there, in that area, for taking part in this search. We did acquire a government claim, and we did do some work, but the plan proved to be impractical, and in due course failed. I then went briefly back to my home area in San Fernando, where I had lived throughout my childhood and worked with my father for a time on his orchard, and then returned to Halcyon. This was around 1914 or 15. It was at Halcyon that I met the woman who later became my wife. She was Sarah A. Merrill Briggs, a married woman at the time. She had contributed funds for the publishing of a book of certain of the messages given out at Halcyon, and the book was called From the Mountaintop. She was assigned to the office of Chief of Propaganda for the association, and I became her helper. In this way, I continued to function until I was finally drafted into the First World War of 1917. We had become rather close in our association in the work. After I was drafted and was employed in the Army, she was divorced, and I returned back in 1919, about January or February. We continued more or less the association, and finally, on the 25th day of June 1920, were married. And that was the beginning of a close association that lasted until her death in 1959.